good evening. How's everybody doing this evening, right? Happy Juneteenth, right? Hey, my name is Gwen Grant. I'm president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, and I am deeply honored to be here with you this evening and to introduce our guest speaker. My friend Crosby is traveling, I believe, and asked me to stand in. I can't stand in for Crosby, the leader of this awesome library, the best library in the country. Am I correct? I was just sharing with Charlotte. I mean, this is her first time in our library, and I asked her, I said, you do know this is the best library in the country, right? And she said, yeah, I was figuring that out when I walked in. I could tell. And so, by, you know, with all of you guys here, I know you know we do have the best library in the country, and Crosby and his staff are really worthy to be praised for the outstanding work that they have done to make our library the best library in the country, first-class institution that is connected to the community, that brings the type of diversity and inclusion to all of the subject matter for Kansas City. So I'm really excited to make this introduction of our speaker. Have you all read the book? Everybody got your books? Not yet. You want to hear what she has to say first, right? That's pressure, Sharla. You got to get them to buy those books. So let me introduce Sharla M. Fett. Sharla is a professor of history at Occidental College in Los Angeles, working in the fields of 19th century Atlantic world slavery, the antebellum U.S. South, and race, gender, and health. She is the author of Working Cures, Healing, Health, and Power on Southern Slave Plantations, and Recaptured Africans, Surviving Slave Ships, Detention, and Dislocation in the Final Years. I mean, I showed you the wrong book, didn't I? In the Final Years of the Slave Trade. This is her most recent publication. She has also published in the journal Slavery and Abolition and contributed essays to new studies in the history of American slavery, edited by Stephanie Kemp and Edward Baptist, and Paths of the Atlantic Slave Trade, edited by Anna Lucia Araujo. She has been a teaching partner with the Colored Conventions Project, founded by Gabrielle Foreman at the University of Delaware, and has edited a student-researched exhibit on California's conventions of the 1850s and 1860s entitled Equality Before the Law, California Black Convention Activism, 1855 through 1865. And I was really quite struck by this publication and Charlotte's work, especially as she captured the essence to bring forward the nature of the strength of African Americans and slavery, or people enslaved, because they were not just people who were African, who became African Americans, but from throughout slavery. And people of color, we, our ancestors, and even today, we are resourceful people. We are resilient people. We are adaptable people. And Charlotte brings that to light in this publication. I think you will find it quite intellectually stimulating, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you, Gwen, for such a gracious introduction. Good evening to everyone. It's a beautiful room, and I'm so honored, really, to be here, especially for an occasion for Juneteenth. So first, let me just start by thanking the Kansas City Public Library. It is such an impressive institution, and just from the moment I walked in the door, the warm welcome of everyone, Willie in the back, and I appreciate all the arrangements made for me. It was just kind of a call out of the blue to come here, and I'm just very pleased to be able to share the work on this particular occasion. I love public libraries. I believe in public libraries. My mother took me to public libraries in every place where we lived. I raised my children in public libraries. So, you know, we have to continue to support public libraries and doing this kind of work. So I want to take for my theme tonight a quote from one of my favorite historians, Barbara Jean Fields, who is a historian of American history at Columbia University. And in her book about slavery and emancipation in Maryland, which she called The Middle Ground, she has this quote that I've used a lot in teaching, which says, "Freedom was no fixed condition, but a constantly moving target." That means that it evolves over time, that it's sometimes elusive, but that if you look at African American history, in many different ways, African Americans over time have remained focused and helped to define that really for America as a whole in many ways. So nothing reminds us more of this moving target of freedom than Juneteenth, which is now celebrated not just in the United States, but in Africa, in South America, in the Caribbean. There are Juneteenth celebrations. And I'm certain that many of you have Juneteenth celebrations as well that you know of, but I will go back to the original one, and I assume many people in the room know the story, which dates back to June 19th, 1865, in Galveston, Texas, when the Union General Gordon Granger arrived and read out the General Order Number 3, which was then published in the local newspapers, that basically informed the freed people of Galveston that about the Emancipation Proclamation. It was a point where the 13th Amendment hadn't yet been ratified by the states. And this General Order Number 3 declared the absolute equality in personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. So this absolute equality between former masters and slaves. And even though the Emancipation Proclamation had been declared for enslaved people in areas of rebellion against the Union to be forever free, bondsmen and women in Texas, they were in the remote areas away from the main theaters of the Civil War, hadn't yet had their chance to celebrate. So that day became known as the Jubilee and later took on the name Juneteenth. Now we know from hindsight, right, that in the wake of that first Juneteenth, there were many promises denied and there was much history distorted. And that distortion could be seen in white planter memoirs talking about the happy plantations. It could be seen in films like D.W. Griffith's 1915 Birth of a Nation. But it was also perpetuated by white historians who told myths about the travesty of Reconstruction and set up really the main theme in mainstream history that people like Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois had to refute in his Black Reconstruction, 1935, great publication. So in this context of denial and distortion, Juneteenth, the ongoing celebration of Juneteenth, became really important as a historical witness and a counter memory to those distorted themes. Elizabeth Hayes Turner, who is a Texas historian, wrote, and I'm quoting her here, "Juneteenth served as a potent life-giving event, a means by which freed people could develop a joyful retort to the messages of overt racism and a public counter demonstration to displays of Confederate glorification." So Juneteenth represents an important African-American tradition because it celebrates in the face of the unfinished work of building a more just and democratic society. And even though General Granger's announcement officially validated the Emancipation Proclamation, it's important to recognize that freedmen and freedwomen in Texas did not need General Granger to tell them about the concept of freedom that they held from their own experience. And from their own experience, those people celebrating the first Juneteenth would also have known that the freedom that lay on the other side of that Emancipation Proclamation was going to be very hard won. Frederick Douglass, I'm going to talk about a couple people tonight, Frederick Douglass and James Pennington, but Frederick Douglass first. Frederick Douglass acknowledged this hard road to freedom when he spoke at another gathering, waiting to hear the news of the Emancipation Proclamation. And this one was on December 28, 1862. So Abraham Lincoln had already issued a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, and anticipation was building to see whether, as promised, he would do that proclamation on January 1st. And Frederick Douglass spoke to the AME Zion Church in Rochester, and he said, "The law and the sword can and will in the end abolish slavery. But the law and the sword cannot abolish the malignant slaveholding sentiment, which has kept the slave system alive in this country during two centuries." And he went on to tell his audience, "Pride of race, prejudice against color will raise their hateful clamor for oppression of the Negro as heretofore." And so he urged his audience, "Hence we say that the friends of freedom, the men and women of the land who regard slavery as a crime and the slave as a man, will still be needed even after slavery is abolished." So in other words, freedom in law was not freedom achieved. Freedom remained a moving target and sometimes hard to hit. Now, my book of Recaptured Africans is one of those case studies on the elusive nature of freedom and the limits of emancipation by the law and the sword. It's set in a very short span of years, 1858 to 1860, on the eve of the Civil War. During those years, several thousand enslaved African men, women, and children from illegal transatlantic slave ships were seized by the U.S. Navy. They were temporarily detained in southern ports, and so they embarked on slave ships from the Bight of Benin, from Ouidah, and from the mouth of the Congo River, West Central Africa, and were intercepted on slave ships near Cuba, which was their destination. They were taken in 1858 to Charleston, South Carolina, and in 1860 to Key West. I'm going to be talking more about Key West tonight. And then, under a law that I'll talk about that mandated their removal, they could not stay in the United States. They were put almost within months, weeks to months, on ships and transported to Liberia, where they became apprenticed to Black American emigrant households there. So we have a lot of different places that are all brought together within this one story. But even though the news of these so-called recaptured Africans, or in the British world they were called liberated Africans, that sounds better, but they really were in this liminal area between slavery and freedom. Even though the news of these recaptured Africans were in newspapers that range from the New York Times to small Wisconsin papers. I found news of it out in Wisconsin, in San Francisco, Texas. You know, people knew about this story in the mid-19th century. But it's a relatively unknown story today. And I think that is in part because it complicates a very traditional narrative of North and South and slavery to freedom. And within the bounds of the United States, it's really a more global story. The discovery of something that I had not known about, even in my classes as a graduate student, was partly what drew me to study this. I also grew up as the child of medical missionaries in what is now the DR Congo, and because many of the young people who were on these illegal slave ships had come from that area, I was really drawn to the topic as well to try to learn more about it. And as I dug deeper into the history, I found out that even though relatively unknown today, many African-American abolitionists and activists of the time did know. They printed it in The Liberator and the Anglo-African Weekly and other Black newspapers, and they took interest in the cause of these recaptive Africans, and they protested the continuing slave trade. So tonight, in honor of Juneteenth, I'm going to focus on the part of my book, it's one chapter, that looks at how a particular African-American activist, James Pennington, spoke out on behalf of seeing some kind of justice for especially young recaptive Africans. And he saw their issues as connected to his own as a formerly enslaved man, as a fugitive. He connected these issues in a kind of global vision of what true emancipation would look like. So after a brief overview of this particular era of the transatlantic slave trade and the efforts to suppress it or to shut it down, I want to turn to James Pennington and other activists to talk about what this story would have meant for him. If you have questions about the recaptives themselves, I can talk more about that in question and answer about where they were from and how they expressed their resilience. You put that so well in your introduction. But James Pennington is really caught my interest here because he used the language of human rights to address what a meaningful emancipation would be. And it was really a lonely voice in the midst of a lot of ugly language. So at this point, bear with me if you know this already. I need to do a little bit of overview about the transatlantic slave trade. And this is done in maps, which sanitizes the process. You know, when we talk about statistics, it sanitizes all that pain and all that suffering. So I take it as, you know, that's part of what comes with this. It's not only these maps. But the transatlantic slave trade is known by historians as the largest forced migration in human history. It stretched for 350 years. The first known voyage began in 1514, and the last known transatlantic slave trade voyage, although there were other kinds of forced voyages that continued and forced labor that continued afterwards, is 1866. And the numbers themselves are much debated and have importance. But the best known estimates that many historians accept is that 12.5 million men, women, and children were forcibly put in the holds of slave ships. There was a great mortality on that middle passage, and that 10.7 million disembarked in various parts of the Americas. However, there was an illegal slave trade. That part, much of that 350 years, was absolutely legal and upheld and defended by the Bible and all kinds of arguments. Then there was a beginning in about the early 1800s, slaving nations, for various reasons, began to outlaw this brutal traffic. Both the United States and Britain did this early on in 1807 in a law that went into effect in 1808. And for a long time, that was the African-American celebration, the date when that abolition happened. However, this illegal slave trade continued to traffic millions of captive men, women, and children even after those bans went into effect. And that continuing trade and then the domestic slavery that it fueled, where it continued longest, Brazil, Cuba, United States, we sometimes call these second slavery societies, helped to expand global capitalism, and it brought coffee and sugar and cotton into the free homes of the industrializing West. Now, this is a map when you can see the roots of the slave trade shifted in the 30s down massively into Brazil and to Cuba. But this is showing you the roots of people. But if you were to show the roots of the money, you would see a lot of connections into the United States. Because U.S. bankers and insurance companies, brokers, were deeply, deeply complicit in this 19th century period of the illegal slave trade. And they worked with Cuban, Brazilian, Angolan, Portuguese contraband traders in cartels to keep this going and to launder the money that was required to keep it going. By the period of time that I'm studying in this really late final years of the slave trade, the numbers had diminished, but still in the tens of thousands per year. And this is a little later, so it's an even smaller pathway. But you can see that it is exactly the two places where the captives that I studied came from, Bight of Benin, West Central Africa, and headed to Cuba. One of the particularly disturbing aspects of this period of time, is that the number of children in this transatlantic slave trade increased over time. In the 18th century, And I should say that different societies define children in different ways, but most societies can agree when someone is young and has not come of age. And so one measure that historians have used is to look at people who are 15 years of age, younger than 15 years. So if we use that measure, acknowledging that really childhood is a cultural construct. But if we use that measure, the proportion of children younger than 15 rose from, in the 18th century, 23%. But by 1866, overall, 46.1%. And from West Central Africa, from that Congo River area, where most of the recaptives in my study had embarked, not their original homeland, but had embarked, that percentage exceeded 50%. These are devastating numbers with the very deep implications for how people survived, what kinds of resources they had as people, what memories and knowledge they carried with them. And this is really something that historians haven't looked at enough, is how did children come through this passage? If in my own research, this is one list from one of the transport ships to Liberia, and you can see these are all West Central Africans. These are not their names they are born with. They've been renamed for Liberia with English names, but you can also see ages, 9, 10, 11. These would have been ages that would have been told to them in translation. So we don't know for sure if these are actually how old they are, but it's a record, a relative record. And there were 300 names on this list. So when I put it into a graph, this is what it looks like. And it really, and again, this sanitizes the process, but it also conveys some information about the largest group of people on this ship being transported after being kept in Key West, transported to Liberia, are boys between the ages of 10 and 14. And we see some 8- and 9-year-olds there as well. So in many ways, this is a very sad book. And I had to think about ways to commemorate. If you buy it, read the poem at the beginning, which I did not write, but which a very talented South African poet, Yvette Christianse, writes a kind of commemoration of children in the slave trade. And really, because these are forgotten lives and forgotten deaths that really need to be marked in some way. But what was striking to me was how few observers of the time really saw the young people or thought about this process in terms of the traumas and needs of young people. And James Pennington, who I will talk about, a former slave and fugitive himself, was one who did address the prevalence of children and youth and maybe their particular needs. So before I get into a story, just a little bit more about this category of recaptured Africans. Throughout this illegal phase of the slave trade, the United States and Britain on a much larger scale, it was part of their empire building to enforce this on the seas, designated naval patrols to go out and seize and suppress slave ships. And this was done for any number of reasons, not always foremost humanitarian. It had to do with a lot of global politicking. But I want to be really clear here to distinguish law versus morality, because the transatlantic slave trade was obviously reprehensible throughout its entire period, whether it was legal or whether it was illegal. So the important thing about the illegal slave trade is not that it is somehow worse because it's illegal, but that it created a new legal category of people, and that is the liberated African or the recaptive African, which were captives who came off of slave ships, who were rescued from slave ships, but then were in a kind of a limbo. And there are historians from 4 different continents now who are really trying to put together the story of what happens whether they land in Sierra Leone or whether they land in Jamaica or Trinidad or Guyana or Liberia. What is their story? And my book attempts to do this for the United States history. So in the United States, though, the question of what to do with recaptured Africans, or recaptives, as I often say, became very contentious. As the northern states that had gradually gotten rid of slavery, not racism, but slavery, in the wake of the American Revolution, had become the, quote, free states, and the southern states, slavery was expanding. So the question of what to do with people who had been liberated from slavery was something that was that produced a lot of political turmoil. And this resulted at first, in 1808, the federal law said they would leave it up to the states to decide what happened to the people on the slave ships. And what happened then if they came into southern ports, and this really did happen, is that African captives liberated from slave ships were then taken to southern slave auctions and sold to planters to raise the money to pay the Navy the prize money for intercepting the slave ship. Right, okay, that's the appropriate reaction. And again, Dr. Du Bois was the first in this. His Harvard dissertation was about the suppression of the slave trade, and he wrote about this. But in 1819, a new law was passed, because there was some challenging of this, that required the removal of recaptives outside the U.S. borders. This coincided with a colonizationist movement that many of you may be familiar with, the American Colonization Society, and the fact that this was an organization that was bent on kind of removing freed people of color as they became free. It had some moderate abolitionists, it had a lot of pro-slavery people, and many abolitionists were deeply opposed to it. But the American Colonization Society received congressional appropriations to resettle recaptives in Liberia. So African captives then seized on slave ships, brought to the U.S., were then put on these transport ships to Liberia. And this happened in the case of in my book, on four different ships. You can see the places they came from, the slavers they were seized on, and then the ships that conveyed them to Liberia. Now, I define this Liberian transport also as a forced migration, because the people on these ships didn't have a choice about where they were going either. And I write about the conditions they traveled in. Not chained in slave ship holds, but under a great deal of violence, a great deal of racialized violence, and their bodies and their minds still in trauma from what had happened in the Middle Passage. And so a lot of mortality resulted from that. In the entire two Atlantic crossings, that this about 1,500 people whose story I followed, in two Atlantic crossings in about 9 month period, 7 to 9 month period, there's a 53% mortality. So more than half of them die. And this is why I say this is about survival, but it's also about death. It's a very, very sombering story. So at the time, I want to shift now, though, to talk about how did Black abolitionists in struggle for their freedom in antebellum America also respond to this situation. By the time that James Pennington became involved with recaptured Africans in 1860, he had already thought very deeply about enslavement in the United States and about the transatlantic slave trade. How many people know about James Pennington? How many people have heard James Pennington's name? Here's his name, okay, Reverend Dr. James Pennington, okay. He's not as well known as Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth, and in part because he had a decline in his career, and I can talk about that as well, and died in relative obscurity. But at the time, he was a person of great stature and leadership in many of the different African-American institutions that were built in the North. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about his life. He was born the year the transatlantic slave trade was abolished in 1807 on Maryland's eastern shore. He experienced from age 4 the separation of his family when he and his mother were given as a wedding gift to the planter's son, and they had to be separated from their father. He experienced violence. He was beaten by overseers age 8 or 9. At 9, he was removed from his family and sent out to work and learn a trade from a stonemason. And then in his narrative, The Fugitive Blacksmith, because he later learned blacksmithing and carpentry, he wrote about how he stole himself to escape as he came of age. He was about 19 or 20, can imagine that, you know, taking that dangerous journey north. He came through Pennsylvania with some Quakers, but then he settled in Brooklyn. And there he became part of a free black community in New York, which was New York itself, in that very year he had arrived, had just passed a law to completely abolish slavery once and for all. Pennington became a teacher. You can see his portrait here. You can see he's a man of great dignity. He studied divinity at Yale. He was the first African American to study at Yale University, but they wouldn't allow him to actually sit with the white students. He had to kind of audit from the back. But he became an ordained minister. And one of the things that happened to him that's relevant to this story is that he became involved with the cause of the Amistad captives in 1839. And many of you may know that story from various histories, maybe from Marcus Rediker's book, the story, but the Steven Spielberg movie especially. And these are Mende, men and some children as well, who rose up on a Cuban slave ship and who took over the ship and eventually, through a long and convoluted process, ended up in the United States on trial, in a trial that went all the way to the US Supreme Court, and they were determined to be free. And so in the process of this, abolitionists got involved in this, and James Pennington was a preacher at the Talcott Congregational Church in Hartford, Connecticut, and he met with these Amistad shipmates many times. And he, in fact, formed a mission society to try to figure out how they could help them go all to their own homelands under conditions that of their choosing, but also to plant a mission in West Africa that he hoped would not have the overtones of colonization. So we can discuss that. But through meeting the Amistad men, Pennington was able really to think about what freedom could mean for slave trade captives who had been declared free by the court, but they hadn't an effective freedom because they were still far from their homes, they were still dependent on these abolitionists, and so he, you know, he had a chance to think about that. He also traveled extensively in his 30s and 40s, attending peace conferences and abolition conferences throughout the 1840s especially. But during this whole time, he was painfully aware of the vulnerability of African-descended peoples really around the Western world, because wherever he traveled, he could be seized and taken by U.S. law back into slavery. And he lived under that shadow for many years until he purchased himself and kind of got his free papers. And despite this risk, he involved himself in the case of fugitives and kidnapped African Americans, because of both categories going on. He took part in New York's Vigilance Committee, and the Vigilance Committee did financial support and direct action and legal support for fugitive slaves. He offered his own home as a safe house on the Underground Railroad. And his own family suffered a great tragedy. This is in 1854, so we're coming right up on the years where he became involved in the story that this book tells. In 1854, his brother, Stephen Pembroke, and his two nephews, Pembroke's sons, came up and escaped from Maryland, but in the very house that James Pennington, the safe house that James Pennington had chosen for them, slave catchers caught them. And his brother, eventually they managed to buy him out into freedom, but the sons, nephews were lost in and sold away into North Carolina. So this was a devastating occasion for him, even as he was really achieving a lot of status and approbation for the work he was doing as a minister. So taken together, these experiences sharpened James Pennington's sensitivity to the plight of recaptive Africans and really shape his ideas of what a moving target of freedom might be. If we think about it, as we go to the late 50s, the early and 1860, these are in his late 50s, he's turned 50 and moving upward, he had experienced many kinds of definitions of freedom. You can go back to, as a young boy, temporary freedom might have been a respite from the overseer's lash. The freedom of being able to return Amistad captives home, the freedom of escorting people across the border into Canada, the freedom for himself of gaining an education, and he fiercely pursued his education throughout his entire life. So he conceived of himself really as a African-American activist in a very broad diaspora, not only in the United States, but through his travels and his contacts in this broad diaspora. And so I think this is some of the reason why in the summer of 1860, Pennington responds to national publicity regarding recaptive Africans. So, because of time, I'm going to just say a few things that maybe if you're interested in them, we can talk a little bit more about them in question and answer, but why the issue of the slave trade came so into public focus in the late 50s and 60s. One reason, and this is a calling from a Southern reopener convention, was that there was a reactionary wing of the Democratic Party of white Southern statesmen who wanted to abolish the abolition laws and reopen the slave trade to Africa. And they used deeply racist scientific racism, biblical racism, all kinds of ways to justify that movement. On the other hand, in the international sphere, Britain was pressuring the United States to do a better job of suppressing the slave trade. So President James Buchanan kind of threads between the reactionary wing of his Democratic Party and the British over here, and he sends out more naval ships to patrol off the coast of Cuba. And this is what results in recaptured Africans who came into Key West in 1860. But this is also the exact time of the Dred Scott decision. It is under the press of the Fugitive Slave Act. So there are many ways in which African-American activists, white abolitionists, are fighting an entire multi-front against slavery and against racial inequality. So as a very avid reader, Pennington would have had a lot of opportunity to read about this story. He never went to Key West, but he responded in words and speech, and so this is the part that I'm going to talk about. I don't know how many people have visited Key West, Florida. So this is the map, and you probably know, if you have been there, that the town is up here, and then there's a ruin of a federal fort here, and the slave trade suppression was a federal action, which is part of what made states' rights Southern people angry about it. On the grounds of the federal property, they built a barracoons for recaptured Africans, and about 300 people died coming off those slave ships, and there is an African cemetery right here. So he would have not necessarily seen this sketch, which I found in National Archives records with the U.S. Marshal's letters about this whole process of how they detained and sheltered and fed and everything that went on in these detention camps. But this was a hand-drawn sketch of what that might have looked like. I think it's there's a woman here with a baby on her back in the front, and there were a couple infants, but there was also an infant burial that happened. But as an avid reader, what Pennington would likely have seen is the Liberator publishing about this, but also Illustrated News had entered print culture in the 50s, and the journals would send several illustrated newspapers instead of our TV that we have today. They would send correspondence to journalists, but they would also send artists. And this is I think many of you have probably seen this if you've done any internet searching about the slave trade. This image shows up on the internet a lot, but it is the recaptives of the slave ship Wildfire that's rendered in Harper's Weekly. Big front page story. But these illustrated newspapers also illustrated, and these are engravings, the technology is engravings, they showed individual people, and they would help to personalize and to dramatize the situation of recaptives in Key West. However, as I also talk about, in most of the mainstream newspapers, and especially in these illustrated weeklies, these kinds of illustrations, which might evoke sympathy and connection, came with a lot of very loaded language about all the assumptions having to do with Africa, and all the assumptions having to do with Africa as inferior cultures and peoples. And scientific racism was applied. And so when I talk about James Pennington, as I will now, writing about, we have to realize how lonely his voice was, and his human rights language that he used was really very, very different than the kind of racially steeped language that was used to discuss the recaptives. So one of the things that is interesting about Pennington's letters to this particular paper, The World, is that there are some very, very good collections of black abolitionist papers for historians to research. But none of these letters don't show up there. And in part, it's because this is a white, moderate reform newspaper. And Pennington wrote about the slave trade in many of the publications. But in this particular case, he was trying to reach a wider audience. And he was trying to change people's minds about what should happen with this forced transport to Liberia. So in these two letters to the editor, they were published in the New York World. Later it becomes Joseph Pulitzer's paper, but in this case, it still isn't. He builds a human rights argument that countered the derogatory and exoticizing views of Harper's Weekly and other newspapers. The first thing he does is to criticize the weak enforcement, the U.S. weak enforcement of the existing slave trade laws, and the lack of concern for the true victims of this trade. He says, who really benefits from U.S. slave trade suppression? Well, number one, he said naval crews, because they have a golden vein, he says, of prize money. Number two, the American Colonization Society, because they're receiving congressional appropriations to use to resettle apprenticed recaptives. And finally, especially the slave ship crews and captains, which come into U.S. courts if they come in at all, and the juries always let them go. And he says, you know, why are they not convicted? There are laws, capital crime laws. Why are they not convicted in U.S. courts of law? He saw the slave trade suppression, as he called it, a brisk business that profited white institutions at the expense of the enslaved captives. He saw it as a political game that was exploiting black bodies for white wealth. But second, then, he turns to the recaptives themselves, and he challenges the removal policy to Liberia as one that's based on racism and greed instead of humanitarianism. And we can get a sense of his, I'm going to read this longer quote. He first condemns the slave traders for wrongfully and wickedly tearing from their homes almost 2,000 living Africans. But then he also says, he questions I'm going to read his words, the justice and humanity of hurrying them back, either to run the risk of dying on the return passage or to be thrown upon a strange part of that immense continent where they will never reach their own homes. Because Pennington had enough knowledge of the continent of Africa to understand that Liberia wasn't the Bight of Benin. That Yoruba captives were not going to find their people in Liberia, that Congo captives were not going to find their people in Liberia. And there's a whole story about what happens to them in Liberia. Some of them try, and eventually in the next generation, do return to their homelands. But with this argument, he focused on what the consequences for recaptives of U.S. policy. And he instead thought that they should be allowed to stay in free homes of the North. He did think they should be Christianized, so you know we can debate that. He did think that they had something to offer to, what he wanted to do was have them teach their languages to African-American missionaries, and then to kind of create this exchange and of missions between Black America and West Africa. So he is a man of his times, speaking a language of his times, but also a visionary voice in his times, because against all of that uglier language I was talking about, he asserted the personhood, the agency, the right to redress for their harms. He considered the emotional and the spiritual state of recaptives. He considered their right to a secure future. And he held not only individuals, but U.S. institutions to account for their condition. Ultimately, this is a story in which these words don't succeed. And you know, I've already told you that there are these ships that go to Liberia and there is this great mortality. But just to conclude and wrap up here, the Key West recaptives left a legacy in Key West as well that would soon be joined to U.S. emancipation. So we come back around to these kind of Juneteenth celebrations, because African Americans in Key West, and there was a population of both enslaved and free people of color in Key West, that was very Caribbean in its nature, lots of connections to the Bahamas. They were not able to hear the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued on January 1st either. It took 3 weeks for that news, not 2 years, but 3 weeks for that news to get to Key West. And when that news did arrive, according to a diary of a Union soldier, people of color in Key West, freed people, free African Americans, chose to observe their emancipation celebrations in the barracoons, the buildings where recaptive Africans had been housed. Now, you know, we might say, well, it was an empty building, it was convenient, but I think there's a greater symbolism to that. Within a 3-year period and in the memory of people who had been there and had most likely been in contact with the recaptured youth and adults who were kept there for 2 months, there was a special resonance there. We can ask, what did it mean for newly freed African Americans to dance, sing, and pray in the spaces occupied by this other group of captives who had been affected by the system of slavery? And we don't have the sources to answer that question completely, but I would suggest that the Key West celebrations can serve as a kind of symbol for the global concept of emancipation that James Pennington advanced in his own lifetime. So this story, which is only one of the many stories here that encompassed in this book, of James Pennington and recaptive Africans whose cause he took up, shows us that the legal milestones, like Frederick Douglass said, emancipation by the law and the sword, are critically important. We have to have them, but that those meanings of emancipation, the full meaning of emancipation, cannot be seized by any legal decree, but by a continuous pursuit of freedom in many evolving forms. Pennington's advocacy against the continuing slave trade and on behalf of young Africans caught in this global ordeal acknowledged that this road to a just society would not be a simple or an easily achieved one. The celebrants in Galveston in 1865 also understood this hard road, but they also knew the value of community celebration. And likewise, the celebrants of Juneteenth, 2017, know that this nation is in a deep struggle for racial justice and democracy, even today. So the events that are taking place across the nation, and you know, we're part of those events, have been devoted to protest, to organizing, and to celebration. And in these events, if we could just take a camera and kind of sweep across the United States, we would see affirmations of Black history, art, politics, faith, community, and those affirmations are constantly redefining this moving target of freedom. Thank you very much. So Q&A is always the best part. Okay, any questions? Yes. So globally, there are 200,000 people and climbing, but the United States portion was smaller, and the numbers change because of the mortality over time. So in Key West, the number was at around 1,500. And then in Charleston, it was about 300 people. But because of this mortality, it goes, you know, from over 2,000 to less than half, and there is still continued death as people are weak getting off of the transport ships as well. So it's there's a lot of just of mortality, but it's not a huge number of people. It's a very politically explosive issue, but it's not a huge number of people, but it's a large number of people. All recaptives who were taken to Liberia were apprenticed for 7 to 14 years. The youngest ones would serve the longest apprenticeships. They were apprenticed in the homes of Americo-Liberians, people of African descent who had migrated to Liberia in this experiment that became Liberia. So they merged with the settler society rather than indigenous people of Liberia. But in the chapter, I just went to a conference in Toronto where I talked about that phase of this, and there is a very striking missionary diary that talks about a group of boys who are sent to this white mission, because the white mission saw them as a kind of malleable group of people who they could acculturate, and they were also viewed as a source of labor. They were working on sugar, timbering, coffee plantations, so their labor was continued to be used as freed people. But there's a whole dramatic story of this group of Congolese boys who escape from the mission, and they spend 5 or 6 days going across the Liberian countryside before they are recaptured as recaptures and taken back and punished for running away. And there was a whole slate of people running away from their apprenticeships. So if you look at that, you know that they themselves did not feel they had reached refuge yet. But later, there are stories of both people from the West African group, who were largely Yoruba, and prisoners of Dahomeyan Wars, who are closer and able to migrate once they have the stability and the means back to their homelands. But there's also a group of Congolese who go, once it's the Belgian Congo, that next generation with their children who go and settle there. So there are continued migrations that happen in different circumstances. Sorry, way in the back. Yes. Yes. Of the illegal slave trade, yes. Well, we know that American universities are really under scrutiny about this now, Georgetown especially recently. So the profiting isn't just in the illegal slave trade era, but in the entire era. And I know life insurance companies, universities, banks. I'm sorry, I don't have specific names of banks, in part because in the illegal slave trade era that I study, they're clandestine rings of international cartels, and they don't have a sign out front. But there are people actually working on the money flows, and who show that for each of these illegal slave ships, there are 20 to 30 shareholders. So there are people who are doing venture capital into these ships. Yes. Sorry. Such a good question. I think that Marcus Garvey's part of a more modern movement of Pan-Africanism. So I think he gets his ideas from the Caribbean. I mean, you can speak to this, right? But there is a continuous flow of ideas about emigrating to Africa. Sometimes it's Liberia, sometimes it's other parts, usually West Africa. But I think Garvey is more of his early 20th century moment. Yeah. My studies of people who do this work. There is a large collaborative database of scholars from England, Africa, US called Voyages, the Transatlantic Slave Trade, and what they've been doing is trying to compile all the voyages over time. So the numbers that I used, the 12.5 million, come from that. And these are embarked and then disembarked 10.7 million. But that does not take into account everyone who died along the way. The Middle Passage is only the Middle Passage. There's a capture, a march to the coast. There's what happens on the other end. And so, you know, if you read, Toni Morrison's Beloved, she says to the 60 million. And so she's thinking about that really broader devastation, you know, just the catastrophe of what that represents. And
no one is agreeing on the numbers from what I've
no one is agreeing on the numbers, and I think there are people like Inukori who would go higher, but it is right now a process of trying to find records for every voyage that ever happened, document that, and then create statistical models that could extend where the holes are. And that's kind of an ongoing project. Yeah, yeah, right. Yes. So one of the things that scholars of slavery talk about is that slavery has existed in all human societies, times, and places. Even the word slave comes from the word Slav and refers to the enslavement of Eastern European people and the Baltic nations. And so the type of slavery and the slave trade that has left its deep legacies for our world is that transatlantic slave trade. But there was a trans-Saharan slave trade. I think it's important to say this institution existed among all people. Europeans were enslaved too, but to also then think, where is the weight of the work and the legacies for us that we're dealing with? That's the transatlantic slave trade. So there's a balance there between those two things. Well, that was part of the trans-Saharan slave trade, but it's also true that there were many enslaved Muslims in the Americas, large groups of people who were Muslim who were enslaved from the West African areas. And that's another story. Sylviane Diouf has written wonderful books about that, so you can look for her books on that. Yes, sir. So this is a question that I am curious about, because in the records I looked at, it was only in those first years of apprenticeship. And one of the interesting things that I can see is that I learned from Helene Cooper, who's a New York Times writer. She has a biography of her family's upbringing in Liberia, and then she has just written a biography of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first woman president of Liberia. And she talks about the fact that, well, let me go back first. In the period of the recaptives in Liberia became known as Congos. So even if some of them, a small group, were from West Africa, because there was this overwhelming West Central African, so they were known as Congos. But if you read Helene Cooper, by the time you get to the 20th century and the coup that really started the beginnings of the terrible civil wars in Liberia, the Congos are people from westernized or who have roots in the West from African America and are set off in terms of Congo versus country, meaning indigenous Liberians. And that was the split in politics, because indigenous Liberians were always kept out of Liberian positions of power. Those are the roots, those kind of early colonial roots of Liberia, even though tragically African Americans were fleeing from their own situation in America, that created the politics that led eventually to the 20th century civil wars. So it's very complicated, and I again recommend Helene Cooper's books on this. But to answer your question, they were absorbed more into the Americo-Liberian or Black American settler households, but they also seems to have remained in a lower strata. I tried to look at who was marrying whom as they came of age, and it seemed like recaptive shipmates were marrying each other, as well as sometimes marrying Black American or Americo-Liberians, but of lower status. And there really hasn't been enough done on this group of people and their impact on Liberian society. Historians seem to kind of jump from the founding and the independence, and then we're up in the coup and the civil wars. And this period in between needs more work. So it's a great question. Yes, but that word broadened to include Americo-Liberians also, and that's why I don't know how that happened. I want to write Helene Cooper and ask her how that happened, because it's somewhere between 1860 and 1970 that happens. Yes. So you might be referring to Nathaniel Gordon, who Right, who was the first slave ship captain convicted under these piracy laws that had been passed in 1820, and he's hanged in 1862 under Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. I don't know that, but it sounds like you do. Right. No, as far as I know, I've only seen trials of crew and captain, not investors. Right. In fact, so this is, I just heard a conference paper where someone was trying to, in this group of liberated Africans in the British world, they actually kept registers of people. The U.S. didn't do this. And they wrote down the marks on their bodies. And in some cases, in the Indian Ocean, the East African recaptive situation, they actually took pictures of them. So this is a huge archive of who individually these people were that get beyond these statistics and the maps. And this scholar was suggesting if you could identify the brands that are actually drawn in the book on the Registry of Liberated Africans, and then trace from the brands back to the business that brand represented, maybe you could go to reparations on those specific businesses. But that was something that she's just kind of starting on to try to understand that. I thought that was fascinating. Thank you very much.